And good morning, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Other Side of Midnight. You know, that kind of interesting time, less and less separated from daylight, which we began when this show started a year ago. We kept saying, oh, there's this all this cool stuff at night. During the daytime, we ignore it. Well, the cool stuff, as I have noted on several occasions now, is kind of slopping over, and daytime is becoming even more exciting than the stuff at night. I'll give you an example. There's been a guy running around the country. There's a story in Radio with Pictures. Go to theothersideofmidnight.com. Click on Radio with Pictures. That will take you down to my items and my guest items this morning. Item number two, Joshua Monroe. He's been making, under a very curious set of circumstances, about six or seven life-size nude statues of Donald Trump. And they've been showing up in all kinds of major cities. And everybody's all, you know, oh, isn't it terrible? You know, it's a terrible figure. It's a you know, a disrespect of the candidate. Yeah, really, in this election. But everybody seems to have missed the important point, which is go to Google or click on our Radio with Pictures tonight. There'll be a close-up showing up at some point. The statues are all wearing a ring. Donald Trump, in terms of the persona of the statue, is wearing a ring, and the ring is a Masonic ring. Now, as far as I know, Donald Trump is not a Mason. But that's not the point, because over the last several shows, particularly when we've been discussing this election from the unusual other side of midnight perspective, I have been saying for a long time that what you're seeing is not what you're going to get. Do not make the mistake of assuming this is a standard election. It is not, it is not, it is not. And the changes, I mean, he's now changed his stance, Donald Trump, on deporting 11 million illegal Mexicans here. Suddenly, it's okay for them to stay. I mean, nothing is as it appears. Nothing is fixed. Well, the appearance of these statues with the Masonic ring, to me, is interesting affirmation of a pattern that I have been finding in this election for some time. I think that Donald Trump is representative of some kind of secret society, not the Masons, but some other group. And I've made allusions to this before. And I also think that Barack Hussein Obama, current president of the United States, 44th president, is another member of the same secret group. Oh, my God, you mean that Obama and Trump are secretly on the same side? Yes, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, cats and dogs, and any ETs listening, that's exactly what I'm saying. So on the theme of ETs listening, and we're going to pick up on this on probably the next few days and certainly next Wednesday, there's been a huge announcement that occurred today, a confirmation of a scientific discovery that was rumored in Der Spiegel a few days ago and has been actually rumored for like the last couple of years. Astronomers have now found, they have confirmed, a planet, an Earth-sized, Earth-massed planet, about 1.3 times the size of the Earth, orbiting every 11.2 days around the closest star to the solar system, Proxima Centauri, an M-type dwarf star, you know, flickering at like one, you know, tenth the sun's output or less. And the planet is orbiting within the so-called habitable zone, which means it could have liquid water, it could have an atmosphere, it could have life. And you know, it's when you look at these discoveries against the backdrop of what everybody's focused on, which is the election, there are all kinds of fundamental physical science technology discoveries suddenly falling out of the closet that are portending the same kind of revolution that Bernie Sanders opening up his Our Revolution political campaign today presages down here on Earth. And so what we're going to do tonight is we're going to kind of look at the connections between these two revolutions. Because ultimately, without money, without the banking system, nothing gets done. Remember that old line, without bucks, there's no Buck Rogers? Well, tonight that is eminently true. We're going to discuss with my guests the idea that maybe the banking system should lift its eyes and think of bigger things than just what's going on this one little planet, planet Earth, which tonight has a twin almost just 4.2 light years away. And what are the odds of that? When we come back, my guest of the morning, Ellen Brown, and the banking system. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. Welcome back, everyone. You know, no matter how many times you hear ABBA, it's always so happy and forward-looking, and at such a difference with the current age. Listen to this. My guest this morning is well-versed in matters of money. Ellen Brown is the founder of the Public Banking Institute, an author of a dozen books and hundreds of articles on finance, economics, and banking. All those subjects I ran screaming from back when I was in school. Ellen began her career as an attorney practicing civil litigation in Los Angeles. Her interest in financial reform was sparked during 11 years spent in Kenya, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. We got to ask about those journeys, where she began to explore solutions to the challenges of the developing world. Ellen began researching the private banking cartels, their hegemony over Wall Street, and control of the Federal Reserve. She looked for alternatives that might empower regional governments, Main Street, and the middle class. That led her to public banking. Public banks are banks owned by a government or a nonprofit entity whose broad purpose is to serve the common good rather than the shareholders. Public banks foster real economic development and meet the needs of real people, including students, farmers, and entrepreneurs. They also fund long-term government infrastructure planning. Ellen, in her search, discovered that public banking is a very successful model around the world, except, interesting, for here. For example, the bulk of community banks in Germany are owned by community nonprofit organizations. They dedicate themselves to small businesses and their local economies. German public banking nurtures one of the healthiest small business communities in the world. And we could go on and on, but I have a live guest, a real human being, a real expert in something that I'm definitely not an expert in. So without further ado, Ellen Brown, welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Oh, thanks. Great to be talking to you, Richard.
God, where do I begin? Let me ask you the question I ask an awful lot of my guests, because you obviously grew up, went to school. What part of the country did you grow up in?
I was born in California, and I grew up in Michigan and Colorado, and then went back to California.
That was a grand loop. So you grew up and, you know, schools and all that, and the general consensus of society and whatever, and you ultimately went on to become an attorney, right?
Yep. And originally I wanted to be a writer, but in my 20s there was no way of supporting myself as a writer, so I went to law school.
Believe me, I think you made the right decision, because it gave you material then to write about. I mean, most of the problems that writers have when they're faced that big decision is we don't know anything. We absolutely know nothing, and we try to write about something that we don't know. Best advice I ever had being a writer was, for God's sake, hold on, write about what you know. So you want to be a writer, but you got into the law thing. How?
So in truth, I was dating somebody.
We only deal in truth on this subject. Fair and balanced truth.
I was dating somebody who was going to UCLA Law School, and he thought it would be fun if we both went. And I took the test over a weekend, and I happened to do well on it, and then my mother sort of pushed me out.
So. Oh, my God. In future years, we'll call this the Bill and Hillary model, right?
Up till then, I'd been reading all these very lofty things, you know, about the type of thing you talk about on your show, ETs, and who we are, where we came from, what really happened, that sort of thing. And then I had to read these law books, which it was very disturbing to like bring your consciousness down to that level. But it turned at the time it, when I was reading them over the summer, I thought this is so boring. I would never be able to do it. But once you get into it, and you're competing with other law students, and your ego's on the line, suddenly it became really interesting. You know, that just that.
Well, you must have had a natural resonance. I mean, the idea of justice, the idea of representing people who don't have representation, the idea of a legal framework, otherwise we're all hitting each other with sticks and rocks. I mean, that is, at a big level, that's extraordinarily captivating. The problem is, in practice, it has gone to hell in a handbasket. And I want to get into that in some detail in a little bit, but I want to continue on you. Because I now want to ask a question that I ask everybody on the show. At what point in your career, because you wound up going to Central America, working with what, local people on economics? On...
No, actually, my ex-husband worked for USAID, so he was regional legal advisor in Kenya, and then we went to Guatemala, and that's where my, or Honduras first, and then Guatemala, that's where my kids went to high school, and then Nicaragua, and then I came back to the States. So I was actually, that was when I got to write, because I was a wife, you know, Foreign Service wife with lots of staff. And yeah, it was a great place to raise kids, as it turned out, a little bit dangerous. But yeah, it definitely gave you a sense of what's going on in the world. And
well, were you there during those exciting years of the 70s when Allende was being blown up and all kinds of other stuff was going on?
No, we didn't actually. We got to Kenya in 1989. And then
oh, so you missed those
Central
years.
Central America in the 90s, yeah.
I see. So had things kind of settled down?
Pretty well, it was dangerous, but like right after we left Kenya, they blew up the embassy where my ex-husband worked. But we were fortunate that, I mean, nothing happened to us personally, and there weren't any actual coups while we were there.
So when you went from Africa to South Central America, I guess the contrast of cultures was rather remarkable.
Yes. Kenya was the most interesting. But and from Kenya, I went to India for – I went to an ashram and meditated for a week.
Wow.
But so we got to see quite a bit of the world. And what was interesting was that – people everywhere, I think, assuming they have your basic needs satisfied, in many ways are more contented than Americans. I mean, we are so driven and sort of frantically grabbing for things, never really secure. Our system's not really secure. So in Kenya, for example, because nobody had anything and everybody lived in, the weather was great, so you didn't need much in the way of shelter. And people, if you just had a little garden and some chickens, that tended to be what people had, and they ate simply and they didn't overeat, so they didn't have all those diseases we have. I don't know, it's just a different, and definitely in Central America, people seem, they just have sort of a natural earthy resonance or awareness of who they are and where they're from. I don't know. It's quite striking that money is not the root of happiness.
Except here. And
yes,
it isn't even here. It's obviously the illusion. But there are so many people chasing that illusion. That what makes us different? What did you decide makes us different than other parts of the world where actually largesse is not freely available? It's really hard for an awful lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we'd... partly it's the idea that we are the land of opportunity, and we really aren't. I mean, people are, you have to try to compete to acquire, and the mark of happiness is supposed to be how much you accumulate, but you can tell that people who have a lot aren't necessarily happier than people who just have the basics but have family and, you know, maybe a work that they enjoy.
Well, all right, let me ask this then. At what point did you became a lawyer, you went there because you were, you know, involved with someone. You found obviously that you liked it. How did that evolve into this intense interest in the banking system?
Well, actually, it was before I went to law school that I read about the Federal Reserve and how our banking system worked. But I didn't really know what I, and I thought that was keenly interesting and shocking, but I didn't really know what I could, like you said, you know, we as beginning writers don't really know enough except just a little bit of what we read. I didn't know what I could say that was different. And I didn't at that point necessarily have the writing skills to make it clever and interesting. But then after, well, after whatever, 40 years of experience or so, when I came back to the States, I discovered that The Wizard of Oz was written as a monetary allegory in the 1890s. So that was my
hook. Wait. How did you discover that? Frank Baum wrote an economic treatise disguised as the most popular television myth of all times?
Yeah, that's right. Well, in 1894, in the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln issued the money directly, which is what the American colonists had done.
Which was like 20 years earlier, 30 years earlier.
American colonists was the previous century. But so basically, Lincoln went back to the original system of government-issued money. Once the Constitution was signed, we did not issue the government did not issue the money. Money was considered to be gold, but there was never enough gold. And so bankers wrote banknotes, which were promissory notes for gold, and they wrote many times more banknotes than they had gold. And that's where our money came from. It actually was created by banks, and it is still created by banks. And that is the flaw in our money system.
Okay, well, let me take you thousands of years further back. Really, really. I mean, we talk about banking, we talk about bankers. I mean, let me throw out a proposition that without banking, civilization would never have gone anywhere, because banking allows you to access more resources than you personally have at the moment and do incredible things if you kind of know what you're doing and someone will support you. That's the concept of banking. Someone loans you the resources to carry out a dream, and that benefits ultimately socially many, many, many more people than were involved in the original transaction. That, in my mind, is the origination of the concept of banking. You borrow resources from more people than just you so you can accomplish bigger things that benefit everybody.
Yes, but the banking system we have now and that we've had for the last 300 years, that the money is actually created as credit on the books of banks.
Okay,
and excellent system. I mean, we need that credit.
Before we get there, how did we evolve from an original banking, which I guess would have been more like barter? I mean, we have to go through the Templar era, right?
Yeah. Well, if you want to go back to the Sumerians.
Well, yeah. But the Sumerians were the models for the Templars. In other words, that banking system, as given to us by Hammurabi and those ancient Assyrian and Sumerian and Babylonian cultures, is basically, remember in the New Testament, we have Jesus railing against the money changers. The bankers as reviled members of society that are so critical that you have to support them, but you hate them at the same time, kind of sounds like lawyers. That's very, very ancient. So where did we get off the track? Where between the founders, let's not go back to Sumeria, let's go with the founders. You know, the creation of the United States, there were vigorous arguments between central banks, a government bank, and a private banking system, and that actually led to assassinations, it led to duels, it led to people being lionized. And it led to where we are now. So let's start with the founders. What was the original concept for the American people in terms of borrowing money to accomplish bigger things than they could by themselves?
Well, in 1691, the governor of Massachusetts was short of money. And at that point, that you didn't have banks all over the place that you could borrow from. I mean, there was the Bank of England in England, but they didn't. They were out in the frontier. They didn't have banks. So he got the brilliant idea of just writing these little paper receipts to pay the soldiers. And then the receipts were, they were basically receipts from the government acknowledging goods or services delivered to the government. So everybody in the community appreciated that this was a community debt, and they all accepted those receipts as money. And
so these were just IOUs then?
Yeah, IOUs from the government, and that was the original paper.
And if you went to cash them in, you got what? Gold? Silver?
No. Well, I mean, they had a value in gold and silver, but if you took them to the government, they would they were good in the payment of taxes. They would take them back, in other words. They were like receipts against an advance against the debt of the people to pay taxes.
But they were not used as normal currency in the community at large.
They did not say they were redeemable in gold. No, they were. They were paper currency or paper script issued by the government. So that was our original money system, and it worked brilliantly well. Some of the northern colonies did tend to issue too much because it was a lot easier to issue this stuff and pay for the things you needed than to get people to pay their taxes. This was back when people were not really accepting of government, and they just didn't have the things in place that we have today. So some colonies did tend to inflate their money supplies, which devalued the currency. And then the merchants in England were complaining that they couldn't tell what the value of this currency was, and so the king said that some colonies could no longer issue their own money. And then, but one colony that was doing this had an excellent model, was in Pennsylvania, where they actually did not inflate the money supply. The government printed currency and lent it to the farmers. So the farmers would then pay it back at 5% interest, which was a better rate than what they could get from the Bank of England. And again, there weren't bank branches around anyway. So this created credit that went out into the community, and it made Pennsylvania a very wealthy and prosperous state, and of course, colony. And Benjamin Franklin was instrumental in that. He was called the father of paper money. Not that he invented it, but he wrote about it and popularized it. And he actually he was a printer, so he printed it. And then when the king, King George, forbade the issuance of paper script, Benjamin Franklin went to England and petitioned and said, you know, this was a great thing for the colonies, that this was the basis of our unusual flourishing and productivity, and that it made us independent. We didn't have to borrow from the Bank of England. Well, that was obviously the wrong thing to say. This alarmed the Bank of England. And
so what about Ben Franklin, actually, you know, wise Ben, poor almanac Ben, he actually told the King of England, hey, we're not going to need the Bank of England after a while.
Yeah. So the Bank of England, of course, leaned on the king, and the king then forbade all the colonies to issue their own money.
Wait. Let's look at this another direction. Was he actually there as an agent provocateur to create a dissension that would lead to independence? Because nobody could be that dumb. Think about it. Think of the huge role that Ben Franklin played in the revolution.
Mason, I guess, but
when did this conversation take place?
I'm thinking it was around 1760-something, maybe 1765 or so.
So 10 years later, we break free.
Yeah, well, then what happened was, because we didn't have any currency,
no American
currency, and so there was a huge depression, and the colonists rebelled, and they just started printing their own money.
See,
anyway,
the plan worked.
An act of rebellion, and that.
Ellen, the plan worked. If it was a plan, no, seriously, think about this.
Yeah.
How do you get people to revolt? What's the big cause on both sides of every election? It's basically economics. You say the other people are idiots and they're not doing, they're not spending their money, your money wisely, they're taking too much of it. And then the other side says equally weird things. This looks to me like he planted the seed knowing how the Bank of England would respond, and there'd be the genesis, the seeds created for a political revolution. Am I all wet on this? When we open the phone lines, you know, tell me, somebody out there, call me and tell me that I'm wrong. But this, knowing how brilliant Franklin was, this does not sound like a gaffe. This sounds like part of a larger movement. Obviously, you've never thought about it that way.
No, I hadn't thought about it that way.
Okay, well, let's not get hung up on that because there's a lot more stuff to get to.
Okay, so then, because during the revolution, the government printed a lot of this currency, and the Bank of England printed a lot of the currency.
Now, when you
currency,
say the government, are we talking about Continental Congress? We're talking about
13 the Continental states? Congress. And England also printed this currency intentionally to dilute the value of it.
Oh, they went into the counterfeiting business.
Yep, exactly.
Holy cow. Hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning, Ellen Brown, she's introduced me to a fact that kind of floats out there, and you wonder if Ben Franklin actually, as part of a cabal, looked ahead a decade and did the same things that would get the revolution started that are being done these days. Anyway, on the strains of Elvis, you're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and in a couple of minutes, we shall return.
Your child needs a helping hand. He'll grow to be an angry young man someday. Take a look at you and me.
Shake your money maker like somebody about to pay ya. I see you on my radar, don't you act like you afraid of shh.
Music's playing.
If you wanna come get it, stand next to this money like hey, hey, hey.
Shake your money maker like somebody about to pay ya. Don't worry about them haters, keep your nose up in the air.
You know I got it if you wanna come get it.
Okay, the strains of Ludacris, money maker. Incidentally, a couple things. If you want to join the conversation, go over to Facebook. The other side of midnight on Facebook. No, the other side of midnight on Facebook, and you can join the conversation there. It's easier actually if you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, our homepage, and go to the upper left-hand corner, far upper left-hand corner. You'll see Facebook. You'll see Twitter. There's all kinds of interesting conversations. People actually were anticipating Ellen's visit tonight because banking is so. It's so mysterious, it's so arcane, it's so above the level of ordinary experience unless you actually go to a bank, and that's the only banking experience most people have. So, Ellen, let's take people from that experience to when we talk about banking these days, it has zero relevance to what you experience when you go into your home branch and you see teller, Leanne or Nate or whatever. And you basically cash a check or take some money out. In other words, banking these days is so far beyond the original concept. It's become an industry. It's become as inventive and as creative as making airplanes or spacecraft or anything where human genius is figuring out ways to extract money from you that you don't want to pay. Is that accurate?
Yes. What I'd like to speak about is how banks create money. People don't realize that most of our money is not created by the government. It's created by banks when they make loans.
Well, I don't think people even know where money comes from. What is money? And we need to go back to square one. So you want to go to theothersideofmidnight.com, click on Radio Pictures, scroll down to Ellen's items, and there's a series of charts there. Click on the first one. Banks, not government, create most of the money supply. So start, teacher. Where do we begin?
Okay. So this is a chart of the money supply that most people think that it's the government that creates the money, but all they create are coins and dollar bills, and you can argue about the dollar bills, which are issued by the Federal Reserve, and they're not issued by the Treasury. In other words, if the Treasury issued them, they just hand it over to the Congress.
See, you've got to stop there and explain that in 19 – was it 16 – Congress basically got together and delegated its responsibility under the Constitution to basically oversee the money. And it created an agency, not even a government agency, a private corporation that they endowed through congressional fiat with the responsibilities of creating all aspects around our money supply, calling it the Federal Reserve. But there's nothing federal about it. It's a private-owned corporation, right?
Right. But even if it were federal, it's still only 3% of the money supply at most. So that's the lowest almost horizontal line on that graph. And then the question is, what's the what's the one that the exponential curve that shoots upward? That is money that's created by banks when they make loans. And they've been doing this ever since the Bank of England in 1694. That's where our money comes from. Banknotes for more than originally it was gold, and the banks would issue like 10 times as many banknotes as they had gold because they knew that most people wouldn't come for their gold. And so they could get away with it. And that's still the basis of our 10% reserve requirement. But here's how they do it. If you go to the second chart, they do it by double entry bookkeeping.
Back to Radio with Pictures. Scroll down to the second graph under Ellen's items. The magic of double entry bookkeeping.
So let's say you took out a $500,000 mortgage. The bank would, this is a negotiable instrument. It's something that's basically money. The bank turns your IOU into money. And in fact, you create the money. It's your IOU. You could go to the grocer and just write him out an IOU, but he won't take it because he doesn't know who you are. He doesn't know if you're going to pay it back. So you take it to the bank and he will turn your IOU into something that you can spend. But the way he does it is he just writes that money into your account as a deposit. So let's say the bank writes $500,000 into your account. They will write it on their books as a liability to themselves on one side of their books because when you write that check to your seller, the bank is going to have to cover it, assuming it's in another bank. And then they'll write it on the other side of their books as an asset to themselves because you are going to pay them that $500,000 over time. So their books come out to zero. It looks all looks fine. But that $500,000 check that's going to go into another bank, that bank will treat as a new deposit. So that's $500,000 that never existed before that Bank B is going to now have in its tally of
deposits. Wait. Like abracadabra, rubbing the genie's lamp, $500,000 suddenly has appeared because one bank has sent a check to another bank?
Right. Now, the banks
do have to... That's a neat trick.
Right. They do have to balance their books at the end of the day, but only at the end of the day. Like, all day long, checks are flying back and forth. Bank B might have done the same thing, created a $500,000 mortgage, and that check might have migrated into Bank A. So they've got these checks flying back and forth, and at the end of the day, they have to balance. And if they don't, they can borrow from another bank just overnight, and then they give it back in the day, or they can borrow from the money market or the Federal Reserve. But let's say they borrow from another bank. So you create a $500,000 check. It goes into Bank B. You borrow it back from Bank B just overnight while your books balance, and then you give it back in the morning. So that's $500,000 that has appeared out of nowhere. They count deposits when they count up the money supply. It includes the deposits. So all that
Ellen, this sounds like free energy. It sounds like perpetual motion. It sounds like creating something out of nothing, like the Big Bang, like the beginning of the universe. In other words, you're saying bankers have now designed a world where they alone can create worth and value, and the rest of us basically just follow what they're doing.
Right. And one major flaw in this system is that they're going to require interest on that loan. So you're going to be paying back over your 30-year mortgage. You'll probably pay back more in interest than you owed on the original loan. So you're probably going to owe $1 million overall. So where's that other $500,000 going to come from? There is an argument that some people argue, well, the bank will pay it back to you, and that's how you can get it. Like, let's say you're paying out monthly something from that loan that the bank gave you, and then say the bank hires you to scrub their floors, and then they'll pay that back to you. And then every month they hire you to scrub their floors, and then they pay that back to you, and you can pay it to them. And in that way, you manage to cover the debt. Well, that's true. But look what happened. You have worked all year to scrub the floors of this banker who did nothing but write numbers into an account. So we are basically debt slaves to this financial system. And as you can see from the next chart number 3, that there's always a debt overhang. There's always debt grows exponentially while productivity and wages grow linearly. In fact, things in nature grow linearly except for such things as cancers, parasites, and compound interest.
Interesting metaphors, comparisons.
Yeah. So we have a cancer on our system, and that is the problem, a parasite on our system. And exponential growth, ultimately, when the parasite runs out of its food source, the whole thing collapses. And that's what has happened for 300 years. Routinely, we had these banking crises. When
you mean the swing between boom and bust, boom and bust. They used to call them panics, yeah, not recessions or depressions.
Yeah.
But this back and forth swing where the system never reaches equilibrium. I always wondered, why was it overreaching all the time? It never reaches equilibrium. Is it because of the greed factor?
Well, I think it's because all money is created as debt, and the debt is always bigger than the amount of money. So you have bubbles and busts. The bubble eventually must – it's a pyramid scheme. And so you need more and more debtors to support the pyramid, and eventually you run out of debtors, and then it all collapses, and then you start all over again. So through the colonial period or all of development in the U.S., as we went across the frontier, there was always somewhere to grow. And then we grew into the third world and pretty much exploited them. And then when we exhausted the third world, then the bankers turned on the subprime mortgage market. I mean, there's always some market that gets exploited, and there's some bubble that then busts. So all these regulations and laws are always about trying to prop up a system that is inherently unsustainable. It's a faulty system.
Okay, hang on. Let's go to number four. Exponential growth is unsustainable, whether it's in a petri dish or it's in money supply, I guess. So, okay, so this is the problem. Why did the founders set up a system that's inherently unstable?
Well, I think the founders meant to set up the original colonial system was stable. If you go to the next slide, that's the Pennsylvania model. That actually worked.
Is this the reason why Pennsylvania was called the Keystone State? It was like the foundation. It was the arch locking in the system that would make it all work?
I don't know, but that's a good, thought.
Homework.
So the way they did it was during the time that the Pennsylvania
Okay, we're on number five now, the colonial Pennsylvania model.
Yeah, so the government issued the money as loans. So let's say they printed $105. Then you can lend $100 at 5% interest. And then you could spend the $5 on roads and bridges and the things that governments do. So you'd have $105 out there to pay back principal and interest. And then you could lend the $100 all over again, spend the $5 all over again, all comes back as principal and interest. So that is a sustainable system. The money all comes back. It's not being siphoned out into offshore tax havens and all those places that big money winds up.
Now, was Franklin involved in developing the system?
It was actually the Quakers that set up that banking system, and they had come from England, where they were already seasoned bankers. That, like the Jews, they had been excluded from other forms of business because of their religious beliefs. In the case of the Quakers, it was because they were so religious that they wouldn't bow to the king. They thought only God deserved that sort of reverence, and so they were considered traitors, and so they went into banking. But they developed a different banking model than the usury model. It was a more publicly oriented community model, and that's what they took to the colonies. But then in the colonies, they had the advantage of, in England, they had to deal with the existing currency. In the colonies, they could issue their own money, so they invented this quite new system that worked really well. And we could still do that. So that's what I think the solution is. We can actually get from underneath this banking system. We need the credit. It is a good system to turn people's IOUs into money. That's what we want to do, is turn people's IOUs into money. But we want to do it in a way that gets the parasite out of there. We don't want the middleman who has control over how much currency is in the system and can make it so that there's not enough currency, and therefore we have to borrow from the banks in order to pay our debts and so forth. You can make it sustainable. And now we have blockchain and other financial innovations that actually make this possible.
Okay, before we get there, let's go to number six, because this apparently is a tiered system where you've gone step one, step two. So the Canadian government borrowed from the Bank of Canada effectively at interest-free, you say here.
Yeah, so that in modern systems, I don't know that, well, even the Chinese, I guess, have just issued their currency directly, but generally governments that have been used government-issued money have done it by borrowing from their central banks, which created the money on the books. Just like our Federal Reserve creates quantitative money by quantitative easing, but it goes to the banks. It doesn't just get handed over to the government. But in Canada, from 1939 to 1974, it was a central bank that was supposed to be privately owned, just like the Federal Reserve. But the social creditors managed to win an election, and they took it over and turned it into an actually people's bank serving the people. And the government borrowed directly from the Bank of Canada, interest-free, because they owned the banks, so they basically got the interest back. And during that 35-year period, they set up this wonderful medical system, free medical system. It's not quite so good right now, because now they are in debt because they went off that system after 35 years. But they built roads and bridges and did all this development in the country and just did remarkable things.
Okay, hang on. If it works so well, why did they go off it?
Good question. Well, in 1974, in 1971, I guess it was, the dollar went off the gold standard.
That was Nixon.
Yeah, and the dollar was plummeting, and so Nixon and Kissinger met with
Trudeau.
Kissinger, sorry,
was that Trudeau at the time?
Prime Minister? But I'm thinking of when they met with some bankers in it's not the BIS, but the Bilderbergers in Sweden. And so they all got together and they decided that they would replace the gold-backed dollar with the oil-backed dollar. So suddenly oil became very expensive because they had that 9-day war that involved embargoes of oil. And so the price of oil shot up by 400%. But meanwhile, Kissinger had gone to the countries that would become the OPEC countries and said, we are going to make you very rich. We are going to quadruple the price of oil. And in return, you will sell your oil only in dollars, and you will put your dollars in our U.S. and London banks, and we'll protect you militarily. So that was the deal all the way up to Saddam Hussein, who broke the pact and obviously didn't survive to.
I was going to say, was the war really about his not continuing with this conspiracy?
I would say yes.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Again, things are not as they appear. So let's go from number six back to Radio with Pictures, number seven.
Okay, so in 1974, the Basel Committee was established. This is part of the Bank for International Settlements, which had its own seedy history. It goes back to in the 1920s. Well, in Australia, they had a very very effective public banking system. Again, that the Australians were printing their own money and issuing their own currency through their own central bank. And the governor of the bank made the mistake of going to England and bragging about how they didn't need to borrow from the Bank of England. It was the same thing that Franklin did.
Mm.
And that they had funded their participation in World War One, and they had done all this development using their own central bank, issuing their own currency. And he died suddenly thereafter of a heart attack at a relatively young age. And some major central bankers met and decided to set up this central banking system where instead of having governments issue money through their treasuries, the money would be issued through these central banks, and the central banks would be under the control of the Bank of England. So they had lost, these were the countries that they had lost as colonies, but they had kept control financially because all the money was supposed to come from the Bank of England, and when they had lost that control, and so they set up this new central banking system, which originally the head would be the apex of the system was to be the Bank of England. But after World War One, England didn't have the wherewithal to maintain it, and so it moved to the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland, which was set up by four big bankers, the Bank of England, the Bank of the German Central Bank.
Deutsche Bank.
Shocked. Well, it was actually the – was it Deutsche Bank? No, I think it was actually the Central Bank.
Okay.
And
so what is graph number 7 telling us? It looks like the Canadian government did something really dumb.
Well, then they joined the Basel Committee, which the new rule was in the 1970s, suddenly we had this inflation and it was blamed on governments borrowing from their own central banks. But that was not what caused it. It was the fact that oil had quadrupled, all these countries had to borrow in order to get the dollar reserves to buy the oil, and so they
let me stop you there, because I've heard from other sources about this transition from gold to oil. One is kind of it's historically very stable. Oil, if you have a limited resource, perceived to be limited, and you're pumping it out of the ground at an incredible frenetic rate, and that rate is going to increase and increase and increase. Why in anybody's right mind would you base a civilization's monetary foundation on such a, pun intended, slippery resource when gold historically has proven to be so stable and so long-lasting?
Well, the problem with gold is there's only a finite amount of it, and they just we had all the gold after World War II, and so we were the head of the system. But after the Vietnam War, we started borrowing, and we obviously didn't have the gold reserves to originally when the system was set up in Bretton Woods, the dollar and gold were supposed to be interchangeable. We said we're going to use our dollars like for the global currency, but anybody who wants to trade in their dollars for gold, we're good for it. We've got the gold. We'll pay you. So then during the Vietnam War, when it was obvious that we were going heavily into debt, de Gaulle called our bluff and cashed in his dollars for gold. And this took a big chunk of the gold. And then England tried to do it. And so that's when Nixon said, close the gold window, and said, sorry, we're out. This is going to bust us. So they went off the gold standard. But they still wanted, well, Kissinger still wanted the dollar to be the reserve currency. And so they had to think of some other way to do it, a more nefarious way. So then the Basel Committee was part of the Bank for International Settlements, this central, privately controlled international banking system that its goal is to control the banks and to control the money system and to be the spigots through which money comes. So everybody's dependent on borrowing from that private system, but everybody thinks that it's the government that issues the money, and it's the government's fault when we're in debt, and the government's fault when we have inflation, when in fact the government has lost its power because governments everywhere have given up their sovereignty.
See, now this is so interesting. Are you a Star Trek fan?
No. Okay. I mean, I didn't watch them, but okay. I'm sure they're great. I just
well, there's a certain classic incident in Star Trek called the Kobayashi Maru, where they basically train students, future captains of starships, and the Kobayashi Maru sends out a distress signal, and the potential student, you know, playing captain is supposed to answer the distress call and various ancillary problems, and it's basically a training exercise. Except what the student doesn't know is the computer program is written so they can never win. The Kobayashi Maru maneuver is basically synonymous with a no-win scenario. Mm-hmm. Sounds to me like the current banking system we have somehow gotten into globally, worldwide, is a no-win situation for everybody but the bankers. How the hell did we get here?
Right. Well, and if you ask Catherine Austin Fitz and some other people, they think it's all ETs, because who else would be that powerful? But anyway.
Well, you can have a lot of people that are very smart that can basically harness others' greed. I mean, you don't need an extraterrestrial advantage unless you're thinking of computer power or something like that. But this has been going on for a very long time. We went from, I mean, during the founding of the country, there was this two big dichotomies. I want you to address this. The Hamiltons versus the Jeffersonians. The central bank versus a system that was not a central bank. How come we got what we got?
Well, in this Revolutionary War, the continental currency devalued almost to zero. And then everybody was afraid of government-issued money. They thought it was because the government couldn't be trusted to only issue the, you know, a responsible amount of money. But in fact, it was because the British had counterfeited the currency. Plus, we didn't have all those structures in place that we have now.
So wait, the British basically were trying to destabilize the colonies, destabilize the founding of an independent government, et cetera, as part of their war effort. And money and banking and counterfeiting was a big part of their agenda. Flash forward the film several hundred years, we find the Nazis trying to do the same thing on an industrial level during World War II with the Brits and with us.
Well, and Napoleon did it in
inflating
the currency. And they do it now by short selling the currencies. I think short sales should be illegal. But anyway, like with Greece, the Greeks were doing fine until a bunch of hedge funds went in there and started short selling the Greek debt. And then, the Greek debt. And then all of a sudden, they were in trouble and their interest rate shot up to 30%. I mean, if we had to pay 30% interest on our $19 trillion debt, we'd immediately be
wiped out. I tell you what, hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. Station break, and we'll be back with my guest of the morning, Ellen Brown. We're discussing the international banking system and why has it become the octopus, pun intended, that it's become. We shall return. And welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight. My guest this morning, Ellen Brown. We're discussing international finance, banking, and how it got so... I mean, it really does remind me, Ellen, of the Kobayashi Maru no-win scenario. How do we get out from under a system which is inherently, fundamentally based in a physics that we can never win? Debt piles up astronomically. We can never get out from under it. That's a prescription for the collapse of civilization.
Mm-hmm. But I think we can and we will get out of it. I'm not sure why I think that, but it's my women's instinct or whatever, intuition.
Well, it's like in cultures, when things get bad enough, people finally take action. They get off the couch. Look what's going on between Hillary and Trump. Regardless of the merits.
We have a populist revolution going on.
Exactly. Regardless of the merits of the candidates, people are so fed up. They're willing to jump off a cliff. They're willing to throw themselves out the 95th window on the top of the World Trade Center because of the fires. They'll do anything but continue down the path we're on. So let's go back to the graphs. People are calling. Don't call till about the bottom of the hour. We'll open the lines. I want to get some other basic stuff down on the record. So let's go back to your graphs. Number seven, the Canada's federal debt.
Okay, so the federal debt was very flat, almost non-existent, right up till 1974, when they quit borrowing from their own central bank and they started borrowing on the open market. So the argument of the Basel Committee was that these various currencies were deflating, devaluing, that we had in price inflation because governments were printing the money. But that was not really the cause, but that was what it was blamed on. And so the argument was that governments should quit borrowing from their own central banks and borrow on the market. So borrow from, sovereign debt. So you're borrowing from whoever wants to buy your bonds. But ultimately, we now know that all the money comes from banks creating loans. So ultimately, you're borrowing from banks, and banks are getting the interest on it.
It's such a huge con.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, it's the con at the heart of current civilization. Is it not?
Right. Yep. So you can see from these charts that this debt then shot up in Canada when they started borrowing from banks, private banks. And today they have a huge debt, which if they had been borrowing from their own bank all along, let's see, I had that in my last chart, they would not only not have a debt.
Okay, so we should go back to Radio with Pictures, and we should look at, come on, it's slow, there's a lot of people looking, that's good, come on. Okay, there we are, okay, went too far, sorry, and we look at number 8 in Radio with Pictures, I believe.
Well, actually, 8 is the French debt. You can see from debt that...
ago, a million years B.C., the best things in life were absolutely free, but no one appreciated the sky that was always blue, and no one congratulated a moon that was always new.
This is Bing Crosby, very
so
appropriate.
So it was planned that they would vanish now
and
then.
Wait till we get to the verse. Listen.
And you must pay before you get them back again. That's what storms were made for. And you shouldn't be afraid for. Every time it rains. Pennies from heaven.
Pennies from heaven. Gosh, imagine Ellen back when a penny actually meant something.
Yep.
Yeah, Everett Dirksen, billion here, billion there. Soon adds up to real money. By the way...
We can have that. I think we can have that.
Well, let's before we get to how we can have that, because I do want to present solutions, I want to remind people, if you want to join the conversation, we have active Twitter and Facebook conversations going. In fact, I've got a question from Facebook I'm going to read here in a second. But we also have Club 19.5. If you miss the details, and when you listen to a very densely packed guest conversation, you need to go back and listen again and go back and listen again. And the way I'm structuring the program with the help of M, we're trying to drop in shows so that they relate to a bigger reality than just one individual interview or one individual conversation. So you really need to be a member of Club 19.5. It's only $5 a month, speaking of money, which is, coffee at Starbucks, That's for a month. You get to listen any number of shows, any combination. I'm trying to build a kind of a university archive of the air, so you can go back and relate on the theme of connections to the various shows that relate to each other in ways that you might not expect. And, you know, during the show, sometimes we make references to previous programs or programs that we're actually planning that will fill in the kind of bigger picture. So on that note, let's go back to, well, let me bring up this question, because this was a very interesting question. This is from Mark Fortnot. He says, are cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin a form of financial revolt? Will there be a global currency reset? Ellen?
Ah, well, that actually is the solution I would propose, but not Bitcoin, but blockchain will allow us to eliminate the middlemen, because blockchain makes everybody honest. Right now, the system we have, I'm just writing about this now, it's very complicated. When we used to have fractional reserve lending, where you had the problem of Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life, you know, the banker who is taking in deposits and then making 30-year loans with it, and then when all the depositors come for their money at once because they panic, then you have the bank collapses. So that's
the run on
the
bank, the classic run on the bank.
So we've had banks creating money all through our history.
Okay, so let's go to graphic number 9, because you say without interest, there might not be a national debt, either for Canada, France, the U.S. I mean, how do we get from where we are now, which is really screwed up and obviously driven by greed, to where we need to go?
Well, if the government were borrowing directly from its own central bank or just printing the money directly like the American colonists did, we could eliminate the debt. You could pay off the debt by doing quantitative easing, for example, that actually went directly to the government, or that the central bank could buy up that $19 trillion debt and just turn it into dollars. People think that would be inflationary, but it actually wouldn't, because the $19 trillion debt is money. For example, I have some, or my mother has some money in Treasury Direct that was in I-bonds. So these are government bonds, and originally she had $30,000 there, and we've been using that to pay her board and care. So she's got $30,000 in bonds sitting in Treasury Direct, which is the U.S. Treasury website, and I withdraw it periodically and turn that into cash and pay for her care. So let's say that the government suddenly said, we're going to turn your bonds into cash. In other words, we're going to buy back all the bonds and we're going to give you the money. So instead of $30,000 in bonds that I'm withdrawing from periodically, she would suddenly have $30,000 in cash in that account. Would I rush out and spend it on goods and services? No, it would still be, to me, it's the same money. I mean, to me, we have $30,000 and we'll spend it as we plan to spend it on her care. It doesn't matter whether it's sitting in an interest-bearing account or a non-interest-bearing account. It's still money in an account. And so if you turn the whole debt into cash, as Thomas Edison said in the 1920s, it's as easy for the government to issue a dollar bill as to issue a dollar bond. One just bears interest and the other doesn't. They're both sitting in an account somewhere in the central bank or in the treasury. So anyway, there are ways that we could pay off that whole debt. We never do pay off the debt. It just sits there scaring everybody, drawing interest. It's the interest.
Every once in a while, particularly over the last 8 years since Obama's been president, we've had these. I remember it was August of 2009, maybe, the first one hit where the Republicans refused to basically up the debt limit. And people don't understand that upping the debt limit is not expanding the amount of money you owe. It's merely authorizing a payment for the money Congress has already spent. Right so far?
Right.
Okay. At that time, when Boehner was leading a revolution of people behind him, the Tea Party, who wouldn't let him reach an accommodation, a kind of a big solution that he and Obama were trying to work out, it became obvious that they were going to close down the government because they weren't going to authorize the expansion of the debt limit. And then something got floated around that I find so interesting. Remember all the conversation about the trillion-dollar platinum coin? How, yep, how the Treasury could basically mint one coin under the original Constitution, and that coin could basically supplant all the debts owed by the United States to all of its creditors, backed by the full faith and credit of the United States, certainly not by gold. But it raised such remarkable questions about freeing us from the central banks. Could this not be done in practicality and usher in this revolution?
It could. In fact, that was actually my idea. I wrote it in my Web of Debt.
Wait a minute. That was my idea. Anyway, seriously.
No, it was in my book in 2007.
Wonderful.
And, I actually mentioned it on a Tom Hartman show, and then somebody else picked it up and wrote more about it, and it was discussed.
So you did talk about it on Tom's show. Okay, that's important, because to me, you need we call in the space business a game changer. If civilization is so far down the rabbit hole that we're in basically hawk up to our eyebrows that we don't even own anymore, to a bunch of invisible guys, and they're all guys, old white men, how do we get free? Well, what if we declared we would be free by printing our own money through the Treasury, getting around the whole congressional problem, and of course throwing the international banking system in a total conniption fit? Would that have an upside or a downside, or would it basically be so catastrophic we never can go there?
Well, the coin is...
We could basically return our own power. Why is Donald Trump not talking about this if he really wants a revolution?
Well, he actually did say that.
Oh, he did? When?
People were saying, how are you going to afford all these things that you're proposing? And he said, well, you forget that the government has the power to, you know, the government issues money. It has the power to issue money. So he did say that.
So he's done it again.
People got all over him and said he was going to hyperinflate and, you know.
Well, that's the standard counterforce argument. So why is that not true? Why would we not be plunging into a hyperinflation, which was the big danger around Obama doing it to get out of the problem with Congress?
Well, because our money is debt. So if you just acknowledge that, if you turn it from bonds, which are pink pieces of paper, into dollars, which are green,
they're green and multicolored.
You've got the same amount of money out there. The people who have their money in bonds think they have X amount of money. And if you turn that into dollars, it's still X amount of money. They're not going to rush out and spend that on groceries and drive up the price of groceries. They're going to spend it just as they were planning to spend it. It's money they had in savings that they'll spend over time for whatever they need it for. You see what I mean? If you just turn it into cash, you're not going to suddenly rush out and
okay, suppose this president, you know, because we're coming up to another one of these impasses, I think, you know, the Republicans are saying we're not going to authorize the debt, you know, increase and all that. And particularly now that Ryan is under such incredible pressure from the Tea Party and those about 40 congressmen who basically think that government shouldn't exist at all. If the president were to basically do this, do an end run, kind of map out what would happen after that. How, after the shock, what would the banking system do? How would the Treasury resume control of our monetary policy and our spending?
Well, the reason the president could do it by executive order is that the Constitution says Congress shall have the power to coin money, and Congress delegated that to the Treasury. Let me think about that. So the treasurer has the power to issue the coins, and so the executive, the president, can just tell the treasurer to issue this, to put a large value on the coin. It says, shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. And in fact, the reason I wrote that in Web of Debt was that I read some man who was on a committee in the 1980s to determine the values or how much of these different coins could be issued. He said, well, you know, the government could actually just issue some billion-dollar coins and pay off their debt. And at that time it was billion, and so I wrote, well, now we'd have to make a trillion because the debt is higher. But after he said that, Congress, in their infinite wisdom, decided to put caps on every single coin. In other words, they shot themselves in the foot. They had the power to do this, to pay off the debt, to get out of debt, to pay them what they needed, but they wouldn't do it. They're so afraid.
Well, wait. Doesn't that tell us that they're on the take from the people that basically run the world, which are the banksters?
That way, doesn't it? Yeah. Exactly.
You know, it shows where the real power.
Or they're just ignorant and they fall for this argument that it's going to be inflationary if you allow yourself to use.
Okay, isn't it important we decide which? Because if they're just ignorant, we can educate them. If they're on the take, again, pun intended, you can't change the system from within because they'll never let you. It has to be someone with real guts sitting in the executive Oval Office under the existing law able to take back the country to the Constitution. Is that not true?
True. That's why, from my point of view...
So if Donald Trump was elected by executive order, he could basically, at the stroke of a pen, under existing law, return, get us off the Chinese debt nonsense, return us to a nation creating its own money supply against its goods and services, which basically is inflation-less. And in other words, at the stroke of a pen, the president who had the guts to do this could do it.
That's right. And that's why
that's
you
astonishing.
Need a president that's got some guts.
But see, that's so astonishing because nobody knows that. And again, Trump is... I've never seen somebody running for president with one foot on the accelerator and one foot on the brake. It's like he does interesting, amazing things, and he does all these stupid things, almost like his amazing things are designed as messages, as threats to another audience that we're not supposed to see, because I missed the fact that he said he could create money under the Constitution via the Founding Fathers' original system.
Yep, I actually wrote an article on that, and it's on my website about Trump's.
Can you send us a copy? Because we're going to have guest blogs on the other side of midnight. I want this to be. I'm so excited that you're not. I'm not the only one that thought of this because I kept waiting and waiting for him to do it, and we got so close, and all the language around it. I thought he's going to pull the trigger. He's going to pull the trigger, because I don't know whether you watched. But Barack Obama, in very interesting symbolic ways, has stood up against the city of London and even brought into the conversation obliquely the Pirates of Tripoli in a series of staged events, presidential addresses around the White House with various backdrops and changing the paintings in the room where he gave the address, sending all this subliminal set of signals that we're about to go off the borrowing standard back to we're going to create our own wealth standard. And I've been waiting for him to pull the trigger, and it hasn't happened yet. And then the question is, when could it happen? Could it happen with the next administration if the right guy is elected as opposed to the wrong gal?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking, like, Trump got in so much trouble for just saying that one thing.
Wait a minute. He got in so much trouble I didn't even notice it because there's so much other noise going around.
Yeah,
do you remember?
Of course, I read about, I mean, that's my particular field, so I noticed. But he was,
hang on.
Pulling up my own article. He was called reckless, alarming, disastrous, swashbuckling.
Do you remember the big fuss over the graphic showing Hillary and a pile of money and the double hexagon star, the so-called flag of Israel, which is really a double tetrahedron. And someone pointed out to me, I think it was Robert Morningstar, that in fact that's the sigil of the Rothschilds. What he was saying by that message, that graphic message, was Clinton is indebted to the Rothschilds who created this current banking system we live under, the usury system where you can never get out of debt, the Kobayashi Maru of international finance. And what Trump was doing by insisting that that graphic remain up on the website for days, he wasn't attacking Israel. He was attacking the entire financial banking system. And no one noticed. Almost.
Right. Well, that's the thing. And before you get elected, you have to be pretty careful about what you say. But that would be my hope, too, that if we had an independently thinking president like Kennedy.
But any Kennedy president could do this. And the current president could do this tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So actually, Jill Stein has this in her in her financial policy because I'm her I'm her shadow cabinet treasury secretary.
Really? You didn't? Are you making news tonight? Does anybody else know this?
I've written about it, but this is very cool. Guess nobody reads it.
Well, obviously, my next question then is, can you get Jill Stein to come on and talk to me about all this? Because she has a candidacy, which is important, along with Gary Johnson and Bill Weld. We have alternatives this year we've never had before, but they need exposure. So can you get Jill to come on the other side of midnight?
Well, I'll certainly ask her.
Super. Okay, cool. So let's go to graph number 9, because I think it's important to show people what they could have if they just think outside the tetrahedron.
Right. So if we were borrowing from our own central bank interest-free because we own the bank and we get the interest back, we could probably have paid off the debt by now. The
19.5 trillion that we owe?
So the pillars on the right here are the U.S. debt, and you can only get from the Treasury Direct website the last 24 years of interest. But just in the last 24 years, we've paid $10 trillion in interest on the debt. $10 trillion. Think what we could have done with $10 trillion on a debt of $19 trillion. So the debt hasn't been paid off since 1835. So if you went all the way back to 1835 and you had been borrowing directly from your own central bank, arguably there would be no debt today. And you can see that that's definitely true in France, as in that chart, that previous chart, that if they had paid no interest, they would actually have paid down their debt below where, in other words, they would be almost at zero by now. And also in Canada, they would have a nice surplus had they continued to borrow directly from their own central bank.
So the systems deliberately have been snookered so that somebody behind the scenes makes off with everything and the rest of us just have crumbs.
Yes.
But you say it would come down to one courageous president who would act as president since John Kennedy tried to act as president and do the unthinkable. So what I want you to do in the next segment, we're going to open the phone lines. We're going to talk to some people who have questions because they've been circling around. But I want to know what the future would look like, what the United States would look like, and what the world would look like if the U.S. Treasury tomorrow morning, authorized by the president, basically began printing our own money again. So don't answer now. Kind of think about that. Okay? And before we get there, since we have a couple of minutes here to the bottom of the hour, let me ask you this. If quantitative easing is define what quantitative easing is, because we have these terms we throw around.
Right. Well, that's where the Federal Reserve has issued now $4 trillion or so of dollars, digital dollars, that have gone into the reserve accounts of banks. The idea is by building up the bank's reserves, this will cause them to make more loans and that will get more money into the economy. But it hasn't worked because the money has gone to the banks instead of going into the real economy.
Okay, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. One last half hour to go. My guest this morning, Ellen Brown, and we're trying to take apart, to deconstruct the deliberately confusing and confounding and ultimately specious banking system that we somehow all got and we don't want. So how do we go from this to something we do want? We'll talk about that when we come back on the other side of midnight with my guest, Ellen Brown.
You're a rich girl and you're gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. You can rely on the old man's money. You can rely on the old man's money.
Yes. Hall and Oates. Rich girl. Well, we got to try over here. Come on. There's so much rich music out there. We can, M is very good at that. Okay, and we are back on the other side of midnight. We met Hall and Oates. I used to think it was Holland, like carrying oats, until I looked one day and said, oh, my God, it's not Hall and Oates. It's Hall and. Oh, well. We have a caller this morning who's called in. Sign in, please.
Richard, you talking to me?
Talking to you.
Okay, thank you. Bob from just north of Seattle. Got a question for Ellen. On the fractional banking setup, if I understand everything correctly, approximately, a bank has to have approximately 5% cash reserves for the loans it makes, which in her case of the $500,000 loan, that would mean a bank would have to have $25,000 to make a $500,000 loan. And so I take that loan for a house. Now I owe them not only the interest they're going to charge me, but the $475,000 additional above their 5%. On what planet does that make sense?
Well, that's a good point. But, of course, let's see. I think it's actually 10% for the reserves. They may only keep 5%, but technically, on average, it's supposed to be 10% reserves. Yeah, but
so they're making $450,000 plus interest.
Right. But they do have to balance their books, and that would be the argument of the bankers, that they have to take that money in somehow in order to lend it out. Even though they maybe lend it out first, they have to get it back in order to balance their books. But the problem is they're borrowing back money that the system overall has created. Like, multiple banks have created this money, which then finds its way into other banks, and then they count that as existing money. But it wasn't existing money. It's new money, money that was just created by some bank and comes into their bank.
Well, the whole concept, if I can interrupt here, of prime rates, when banks go to the Federal Reserve, they get a special rate for borrowing. You and I can't get that rate. It's called a prime rate. In other words, there is a two-tier system that's actually visible, but it's like air. It's so common now that we don't even think about why should they get preferred rates when it's our money.
Exactly. And after the collapse, they borrowed $16 trillion, I think, officially, and some say as much as $29 trillion. These are in overnight loans, extremely cheap. And the reason and this is all money created out of thin air by the central bank. So it seems to me, and actually the Bank of England has proposed this, that people should be able to have an account directly with the central bank, so that you can eliminate the middlemen. It's all digital. You could do it all by blockchain. And it seems to me that not only should you be able to keep your deposits there, it'd be totally safe, of course, because the central bank can create the money that nobody, you don't have to worry about a run on the bank. But it seems to me that we should also be able to borrow from the central bank, which can create the money. We now know that we're not borrowing existing money. We're borrowing money that the bank just created on its books, and it's a private bank, and it gets the interest. Why not borrow from a public bank? The interest goes back to the people or to the government to spend on all those things that we expect governments to do. So it recycles back in the same way that the Pennsylvania system worked during the American colonies.
It's so logical. Why aren't we doing it? And I know the answer, so. Anything else, caller?
No, at this point, I will clear the line. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And let me give out those numbers. If you want to join the conversation, you can join us on Skype, Enterprise Mission, or The Other Side of Midnight, or dial 505-796-8802. That's 505-796-8802, and jump in. The water's fine. So I'm sorry, I interrupted something you were going to say.
I've just forgotten what it was.
Okay, well, we'll go on. So getting from here to there, which is kind of a theme of the show lately, you're saying that all it would take would be one incredibly courageous, ballsy president to do what Kennedy was thinking of doing. He didn't actually get killed for doing what everybody thinks he did with the Treasury, did he?
Who knows why he got killed? There were so many things. There's so many systems that he was bucking up against. I mean, it may have been the military or the CIA.
I call it the murder on the Orient Express model. Did you ever see that movie?
No.
Ultimately, it turns out they all did it.
Okay, right.
So
right.
That's the MacGuffin.
He had
they
a
all
lot
did
of enemies.
Exactly.
Yes,
so they all wound up doing it.
Enemies. Yeah.
But the federal.
But one of them was indeed the Federal Reserve, and there was rumors that he was planning to take the power away from the Federal Reserve and create money directly through the Treasury, and that may have been. We don't know.
So forget the rumor. If you go and look at the existing law now, again, going back to our platinum coin conversation, President Obama or the incoming president, to basically get us out of this morass, could authorize the Treasury to print any denomination in any form under the law, and it would be legal. It would be valid tender.
Only of that one coin, the platinum coin, which is a commemorative coin, and the reason... I mean, we don't know why they left that one open, but all the rest have a ceiling on them. The ceiling was only imposed in the 1980s when Congress realized.
So it's specific to platinum. You realize, Ellen, of course, you haven't followed the physics stuff we've been doing, but physics is kind of equivalent to money in banking. Money is energy in banking, and in the physics, the energy comes from the ether. In the physics conversation, there are key numbers that are critically important, 19.5 being one of them. We're a whisker away now from the debt being $19.5 trillion, a number that Trump himself has been enunciating in various ways. $19.5 trillion. Okay, if under the existing law with that interesting loophole, the president could authorize the printing of a platinum coin worth X number of trillion to wipe out the debt, or more than one, two or three, whatever.
20, yeah.
Yeah. Platinum happens to be on the periodic table 195 atomic weight.
Really?
So if you're looking at symbology, if you're looking at rituals, if you're looking at...
Wow, that's interesting.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
There's also other numbers that are 19.5 in the banking system. I won't bore everybody with them tonight because we'll have you back. But in other words, I'm looking at a system that seems to be based, like all the other systems we've looked at, not just on the practicalities or who can make so much money off charging usury rates, but a system which is basically almost metaphysical, which is designed to keep us down on the farm and keep us poor and keep us in debt, because it's all about control, not about keeping civilization going or allowing it to flourish.
Right. No, I agree. That's... The idea was to farm people. I mean, we are the slaves of some system. Who knows where it's from? It could be an extraterrestrial system. I think.
Well,
that's,
when you say
incredible.
Extraterrestrial, you know, most people are going to kind of think little green men and all that. Are you familiar with the work of Joseph Farrell and Richard Dolan and a few other people like that?
Yeah. Well, I
in
think
terms
it would
of
be
this break,
ETs that go back several, you know. Maybe 100,000 years. I mean, they've been here a long time. Like, we may all be extraterrestrials. In other words, we're all genetically modified Neanderthal men. In other words, so ETs came in, needed some workers, and so they genetically modified the highest life form that they found here in order to... I mean, there's a lot of evidence for that. The difference between us and the next highest life form is finger thumb, the ability to hold tools, the tongue, the ability to form words like you have.
Yeah,
different
but the question then is, wouldn't it be easier just to build AI, to build robots, you know, a million datas? In fact, there's evidence in the lunar photographs of something that looks like a robot head sitting in the moon in Shorty Crater. So, again, when I talk about ETs, I'm not talking about aliens, Ellen. I'm talking about human beings. And there's a whole body of evidence now that says that civilization is kind of broken into at least two halves. The breakaways, who have stunning technology, finance, they basically own the world, were kind of their pet project. They divorced from the mainstream of society maybe 100 years ago, around the time of Tesla and all that, is now the earliest evidence. The mystery of the airships of the late 1890s, incredibly advanced technology, and people were actually approached, human beings were repairing these amazing airships, and it turns out that a couple of them have traceable pedigrees to bankers and people from West Point in one New York scenario. So there appears to have been a movement. to take high finance and high technology and to separate from the main human realm about a century ago. If that was true, Ellen, what would it look like in terms of our open banking system? What kind of anomalies would we see if we're but a shadow of a much bigger and much richer culture because they've had access to the entire solar system and science and technology, and we've basically been kept down on the farm?
That may be what we have going on. I mean, it sounds like that is what it looks like. Yeah. Oh, anyway, I think we can break out of this system, and what is going to free us is the internet and the fact that we have and blockchain and the ability to compound information. I mean, I'm just blown away by the internet itself. Like when I was trying to write books in my youth, in my 20s, you had to go to the library, you would check out the books, you would maybe Xerox a bunch of pages. The first book I wrote was on a medical book, so I went to the medical library and I went up and down the elevators carrying these heavy books and Xeroxing the pages, and then I'd get home and I wouldn't have the right pages, or you know, something was missing, I wouldn't be able to find the books. And so I just couldn't get to the end of my thinking, particularly on banking. And then with the explosion of the internet, now you can just formulate an idea. And if you can phrase it right, you can pull up all this information that it's quite amazing.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
But isn't it almost
of our own brains?
But isn't it also kind of appropriate in that through the internet, through people like you, we have the tools to basically confront these large mega conspiracies, deconstruct them, and to come up with viable alternative solutions. Like, here's a question from one of our Facebook people. Again, go to Twitter, go to Facebook, upper left-hand corner of The Other Side of Midnight, join the conversation. Lou Hagbach says or asks, what is a shadow treasurer?
The shadow cabinet, you know, in England, for example, the Labour Party has a shadow cabinet. So these are all the positions that if they were in power, they would have been like the treasurer and the secretary of state, etc. So they have a shadow person who is playing those roles. So the Green Party, which Jill Stein is the presidential candidate for the Green Party. So the Green Party has its shadow cabinet, which are a number of people who are all, I mean, I don't know how I got to be treasury secretary, but somebody asked me if I wanted to do it, and I said, sure.
And you were dumb enough to say yes.
Right. I ran for California state treasurer on the Green Party tickets. I wound up going to Green Party conventions and meeting people.
So this is kind of like during the FDR era, he would refer to his kitchen cabinet, meaning just a bunch of people informally that you gather around, the best minds, the best brains you can find, and who are dumb enough to actually say yes, and you basically pitch them all the problems you can't solve yourself.
Right. Well, and that's what you would hope, for example, if Donald Trump gets in or anybody gets in, you know they can't know everything about everything. They've got to have... Or even Lincoln, you know, he was. There was that famous book by Doris Kearn, whatever. Anyway, about Lincoln, how he pulled in all these advisors that were actually something of rivals.
Cabinet of rivals, yeah. Well, that's what Obama did with Hillary, which was what everybody thought was going on.
I think Obama made a mistake. He pulled in people that were too powerful as
rivals. The mistake he did not make was making her vice president. That would have been the mistake. Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
No, I'm thinking about the other people he pulled in.
People like Geithner? Yes. Okay. You want to talk about why Geithner was not the right guy?
Well, I wish I could remember the name of that book. But anyway, by Doris Kearn. Anyway, about Lincoln, what Lincoln did was pull in his political rivals as his advisors, and they all formed a team, and it
a team of rivals. M comes through again.
Yeah, was that a team of rivals? Okay. And Obama apparently saw Lincoln as his mentor. I wrote an article on that he should therefore have duplicated Lincoln's monetary system, but obviously he didn't read it or he didn't think so.
Well, there's something else very strange about Obama and Lincoln. I mean, we all agree that he really idolizes Lincoln. That's been his role model. Remember, he did the announcement outside the State House there in Springfield where Lincoln, you know, announced and served and all that. So why did Obama not go to the anniversary, the Lincoln anniversary a couple, 3 years ago? Why was he a major no-show?
I don't know. I wasn't aware of that.
Why did he not want to emphasize his Lincoln connection?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I don't know either.
Obama's team, he brought in these powerful bankers, and they just supported the banks. I mean, if you're asking for advice from the enemy, you're going to get the enemy's ideas. I mean, he really should have brought in people that, you know, people that are serving the public. But anyway.
But remember, his term is not over yet, and he still has the platinum coin option. Wouldn't that be astonishing? Wouldn't that be amazing if he did that on the last day?
It'd be totally amazing, but it doesn't. I don't know.
I mean, let's play this out, because scenario playing is what the CIA does all the time. Let's assume that Hillary, because of all the huge throwing of the election that Trump's doing, Hillary winds up president. What if he gave her as a Christmas present, basically returning the country to the Treasury? What would she do? How would she respond as president-elect? How would she respond? Would she cancel it with another executive order? Or would there be so much incredible foment that people would be saying, wait a minute, this is a good idea?
Yeah. Well, the problem is that people won't say that because most people don't get it. And you'll wind up just like when Trump just barely breathed that idea and all these critics got all over him and said he was going to create hyperinflation. People just don't understand why it wouldn't create hyperinflation. So that's why people like me have to just keep writing and writing and beating this idea, you know, beating this horse until people get it. I would love to have the wherewithal to make little 1 minute videos, you know, that illustrated all this in cartoons. But
okay, let me give you another scenario. I've said for about a year that Hillary is not going to be the candidate. I don't know what's going to happen. It's kind of between the email now and the meme that's being spread by the Trump campaign, including Donald himself, about her health. Have you watched this?
Yeah.
It's so peculiar. It's almost like it's sympathetic magic. It's like he's trying to get so many people to think of her as ill so she becomes ill. I mean, we're really talking high-level ritual stuff here. So aside from the mechanism, I have not seen Hillary being elected as the 45th president. So if she can't run, it turns out that the Democratic Party and their rules, they can basically put anybody else that they want and vote them as a convention into the presidency. In other words, into the person that will take over from her before the election, sometime in the next, you know, 2.5 months. What if it was Bernie Sanders? What if he then appointed Elizabeth Warren as his vice president? Elizabeth Warren, who is so known for her assault and confrontation of Wall Street. Between the two of them, what if the trillion-dollar platinum coin option suddenly came into vogue again?
Yeah, that would be amazing.
What would be the downside? Forget the perceptions. Physically, what's the downside of taking that radical step?
Well, you wonder how long they would live.
What would it do for people? How would it empower people?
How do you mean?
Well, every level. In other words, I go to my bank, I want to borrow some money. That is determined by so many things that are above my pay grade. What if the United States printed its own money again? How would it affect borrowing at a local community bank?
I didn't get into the Bank of North Dakota model at all, but we have one state that owns its own bank, and that bank acts as a banker's bank for the other community banks.
So wait a minute. This is one state out of 50 states.
Right.
Under the Constitution, the states can create their own banks, right?
Yeah.
But only one, North Dakota, has. Why?
Right. And they set it up in 1919 when they were rebelling against the big out-of-state banks that were controlling their markets. And they decided they wanted to keep their money in the state for the people of North Dakota. And it's worked out very well for them.
So we actually have an ongoing operating model of what you're proposing, which actually is working.
Right. So a state under the Constitution is not allowed to issue its own money, but it is allowed to issue, to own its own bank, as we see, because North Dakota has one. And a bank can issue money in the form of, digital banknotes the way all banks do. In other words, they issue it as credit. So,
and they do this between sunset and dawn borrowing thing to make it all come out even.
A state has unusual potential because you can take all the revenues of the state and make that the deposits in the bank. And that's the way it is in North Dakota. By law, all of the state's revenues are deposited in the Bank of North Dakota. Now, if California did that, just in the treasurer's investment pool, there's $63 billion. So our treasurer could take that $63 billion, call it deposits in a bank, and you would have a giant bank that could then create $63 billion in loans, even though the money is still sitting there on deposit that they can use as revenues whenever they need it, because they have the ability to borrow from other banks.
So why isn't Jerry Brown, who I've been following for decades in terms of his career, why isn't Jerry Brown looking at North Dakota and saying, wait a minute, we're the seventh largest economy on the planet. Why don't we do what we can do legally under the Constitution and radically change the environment?
Actually, we're working on that. but I have to not talk about it too much because, politicians don't like it to be known if they're what they're doing ahead of time. So
there are conversations in California about doing this?
Yes, there are conversations.
Interesting. Okay. So now you have two things you have to do for me. You have to get me, Jill Stein, to come on and talk about the big picture, what this would do globally if somebody had the guts to do this. And two, what would happen if another state followed North Dakota? Just one.
Yeah.
California, of course, would be huge because California is a trendsetter, but...
Yeah, or even a city could do it because, North Dakota is only the size of like maybe half of Philadelphia.
Wait. How can cities under the Constitution create their own banks?
Well, anybody can have a bank. I mean, private individuals can set up a bank. So why can't a city have its own bank? Cities do have, loan funds, revolving loan funds. If they turn it into a bank structure, they have the ability to leverage that money. So they get 10 times the bang for the buck. If they call their money capital in a bank and then they use their other revenues as deposits in the bank, they can now lend out 10 times their capital. So they can create 10 times what they would have had otherwise.
Wow. Well, we got to have you back. We got to have people reading your books. Give me a list of your books, because obviously, if you thought of the platinum coin thing first, we got to read your books. Come on.
Mm-hmm. Web of Debt was my first book on.
And these are all listed on the Other Side of Midnight radio pictures. Scroll down to your bio, and they're all down there.
Okay, Web of Debt and The Public Bank Solution. Those are my two books on banking. Then I've written 10 books on health and the politics of health. That was my first subject.
Wow. Okay, anything you're working on currently that you can talk to us about?
Yeah, well, I'm working on a paper for the next system project. They wanted 50 pages on how to eliminate too big to fail and how to set up a national public banking system. So I'm, sort of obsessed with trying to write.
Power to basically return us to where we used to be. And on that note, there's our music. We're out of time. Ellen, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And everyone
else.
Thank
you, Richard. Great talking to you.
Okay. And remember, everyone, till tomorrow morning, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.